Hello, and welcome to Southern Living Magazine, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Angela Odie, and for the next half hour, I will be reading articles from the July 2019 issue of Southern Living. Please enjoy. This is from Life at Southern Living. This is the letter from the editor, Sid Evans, the editor-in-chief. Breaking Cornbread, a tribute to an organization that has given new meaning to Southern food. 20 years ago, on July 22, 1999, a diverse group of Southern food writers, chefs, and historians gathered in the heat of summer at the Southern Living offices in Birmingham to create an organization that would use teaching and storytelling to tackle issues of race, poverty, and division in the South. It was a bold idea, and not the first of its kind, but with strong support from the University of Mississippi, the group is fueled by a sense of optimism and excitement. Southern food was on the rise, and there seemed to be an opportunity to bring together people of all races and creeds around a common table. Led by a charismatic writer from Nashville named John Egerton, they called themselves the Southern Foodways Alliance, SFA. That night, they met for dinner at Highlands Bar and Grill, where Chef Frank Stitt served a menu meant to celebrate Southern food with a local provenance. Fried green tomatoes with crab from Bayou La Batre, Alabama, rabbit pilau with Vidalia onions and nasturtium blossoms, and grilled Dustin grouper with cherry tomatoes, okra, and butter beans. The conversation was animated. Stitt talked about the need to accentuate the importance of farmers, and Egerton ended the dinner by laying out a vision for a better South, one in which food could help heal some very old wounds. John Egerton's desire was to bring eaters and thinkers together, says Pardis Stitt, who manages restaurants with her husband Frank. His vision was not to turn away from our past, but to talk across the table while breaking cornbread and dipping it in pot liquor. A young food scholar and graduate of the University of Mississippi's Center for the Study of Southern Culture, John T. Edge, was appointed the director of the organization, and he has spent 20 years bringing Egerton's vision to life and infusing it with his own. The SFA now has around 2,500 members, a quarterly publication and a podcast, both called Gravy, a calendar full of events, a catalog of oral histories, and a slew of short films exploring Southern food culture and the people who define it. His feature in this issue, Southern Food Legends, is a tribute to 20 of them, many of whom have inspiring stories that would not have been told without the work of the SFA. To all of our friends in that fine organization, and to the visionary crew who founded it, happy anniversary! Keep doing what you're doing! From the garden section, The Grumpy Gardener, Our Garden Expert Alleviates Your Growing Pains, by Steve Bender. Oh man, I just saw a man pruning a crepe myrtle with a chainsaw while standing on his roof. Is this an isolated case, or are all men this stupid? Carmen. No, not all of us. However, it does explain why women tend to live longer. Morning Glory. How do you get rid of out-of-control morning glory? It is trying to take over my backyard in North Carolina. Kristen. Morning glory looks great the first year, but a zillion seedlings come up the next. Spray them, according to label directions, with a herbicide that kills them, roots and all, such as Weed Be Gone or Weed Stop. Next spring, apply a broadleaf weed preventer such as Preen to the soil to keep any remaining seeds from sprouting. Bermuda grass invasion. We live in the mountains of Virginia. Our tall fescue lawn is being invaded by Bermuda grass that turns brown in winter. How can we eliminate it? Elaine. Removing grassy weeds from a lawn is difficult because any weed killer you spray to eradicate them will get rid of your good grass too. Instead, create conditions that favor fescue over Bermuda grass. Raise your mowing height to 3 inches. Tall fescue likes the extra height and will shade out the invader. Fertilize in autumn as tall fescue keeps growing in fall and winter while the Bermuda goes dormant. Sow fescue seed in any bare or thin spots this fall, too. Summer leaf drop. Here in New Jersey, my big tulip poplars have been dropping lots of yellow leaves. The ground looks like autumn. Could the hot, dry summer be to blame? Tom. Yep, having a wet spring encourages trees to grow many more leaves than they can support in hot, dry weather, so they drop the extras to achieve a balance. This is especially common with tulip poplars and birches. Watering now may reduce the problem somewhat, but the trees will be fine in any case. Red, then dead. When we moved 2 years ago, our driveway was lined with enormous red-tip photinias for privacy screening. They handled heavy pruning well. Now, their leaves are covered with spots and holes. We think they're about to croak. Can they be saved? Jeremy and Michael. Red-tip photinias planted in the rainy, humid southeast are subject to a virulent disease called Entomosporium leaf spot. The fungus attacks the new bright red leaves and spreads by splashing water. The more you trim, the more red leaves you get, and the more disease. Eventually, the shrubs will die. You can control leaf spot by spraying the new foliage according to label directions with Immunox or Daconil, but I'd replace them with better screening plants, such as Nellie R. Stevens Holly, Sky Pencil Japanese Holly, Emerald Arborvita, and Hixie Yew. Grumpy's Gripe of the Month. I know it sounds downright un-American and definitely un-Southern, but I dislike fireworks. Why? Well, there was that time as a kid when a friend accidentally dropped a lit bottle rocket inside our treehouse with us inside it. On the bright side, I learned Irish dancing. The point is, people, fireworks are dangerous. So this year, I encourage you to celebrate the 4th by planting fiery, colorful zinnias in the garden instead. Around the Garden, a seasonal guide for green thumbs. Summer phlox is the plant of the month. Once scorned, this dazzling native will make a colorful comeback in your garden, by Steve Bender. You might wonder how a perennial that offers months of beautiful, fragrant flowers, beloved by butterflies and hummingbirds, ever fell from grace in southern gardens. That's what happened to summer phlox. Blame it on a disfiguring fungus called powdery mildew. It causes infected leaves and stems to shrivel and turn gray, ruining the colorful show put on by the flowers. Happily, mildew-resistant new selections have won us back, including David, white flowers, 3 to 4 feet tall, Gina, lavender pink, 3 to 4 feet, and the best one for butterflies, Laura, rich purple with white centers, 2 to 3 feet, Catherine, lilac blue with white centers, 2 to 3 feet, Nikki, deep magenta, 2 to 3 feet, and Robert Poor, violet pink, 3 to 4 feet. Plant in sun and well-drained soil in USD zones 3 to 8. Pinching the stems from the leaves when they're 4 inches tall will increase the number of stems and blooms. Your July checklist. Don't stop planting. Despite the heat, you can still set out trees, shrubs, and perennials purchased in containers. Water each one thoroughly in its pot just before planting. Afterward, keep the soil moist around the roots for the rest of the summer. Mulch to cool the soil and reduce water loss. July is also the time to set out small plants of tomatoes, white squash, winter squash, broccoli, and cabbage for a fall harvest. Spray for pests. Loathsome copper and green Japanese beetles are at their peak and will devour the foliage and flowers of dozens of ornamental and edible plants. To kill them, spray the foliage according to label directions with neem oil or 7. Do not apply to flowers, though, or you'll kill the bees and butterflies, too. Nourish your pots. Apply a water-soluble fertilizer to containers every 2 weeks to replace nutrients washed out by frequent summer watering. Or use a granular, slow-release fertilizer that will feed for months, such as Dynamite All-Purpose 1868 plant food. Keep an eye on roses. When strange reddish shoots with deformed flowers begin growing from your rose, it's time to say goodbye. It is infected with a fatal virus called rose rosette that's transmitted by tiny mites. There is no cure. Pull up the plants, roots and all, seal it inside a plastic bag, and put it out with the trash. Don't place a rose in the same spot again. Southern Food Legends by John T. Edge. Over two decades of work, my colleagues at the Southern Foodways Alliance, SFA, and I have learned many lessons about this region we call home. The 20 people profiled here, among hundreds of others, have been our teachers. We have documented their lives in short films, recorded and archived their oral history interviews, drawn inspiration from their writing, and followed their leads on social and environmental justice. We have listened to their voices and heard their calls. SFA is a storytelling organization based at the University of Mississippi, established in 1999 at a meeting of 50 founders on the Southern Living campus in Birmingham. We document, study, and explore the diverse food cultures of the changing American South. From the beginning, SFA has focused on farmers, cooks, waiters, and other working folk who'd previously received too little recognition for their knowledge and labor and vision. We have prioritized sharing the contributions of people of color who were long denied their legacy. We tell new stories from an old place. We frame the South as a dynamic region. We regard farmers and cooks as agitators for progress and cultivators of change who spur the region to own up to its promise. Collectively, these stories of lives in service to the region show and tell how everyday folk have bridged divides of race and color and gender, rejiggered definitions of Southern culture, and charted a path forward for us all. The Fishmaster, Elihu Washington, Jr., Little Rock, Arkansas. Molassie and Joe Watson first sold sandwiches out of their home around 1905. Their business eventually became a restaurant called Lassie's Inn. During the 1957 desegregation of Central High School, Daisy Bates and other civil rights leaders held meetings there. Current owner Elihu Washington Jr. knows that history, and he recognizes that a good restaurant does more than feed, it sustains. Here, warm conversation and buffalo ribs are the preferred sustenance, cut from buffalo fish that's battered and fried and served alongside 40-ounce beers. They are artifacts of commerce and community. The Queen of Soul, Sophia Vaughn, Nashville, Tennessee. The Meat and Three is a modern adaptation of the farm worker's midday meal, served from a steam table to city Southerners who pine for a taste of the country cooking their parents and grandparents left behind. Founded more than 70 years ago, Silver Sands Cafe feeds the Hope Gardens neighborhood. Sophia Vaughn, the third-generation owner, rises each day as early as 3 a.m. to cook down collards, stir meatloaf, and mix salmon croquettes. She works to feed her family and her community. The fierce love she broadcasts to all who gather comes for free. The Sausage Specialist, Robert Patillo, Beaumont, Texas. In 1912, Jack Patillo founded Patillo's Barbecue, which is now the oldest black-owned barbecue joint in the state. In 1981, Robert Patillo, Jack's great-grandson, officially stepped into the smokehouse and assumed responsibilities for more than a business. He shouldered the burden of a fading style of barbecue. In addition to beef clod, he smoked grease balls, sausages that were once more popular in the Gulf South. Stuffed in beef casings and flavored with garlic, red and black pepper, and chili powder, the sausages are squeezed from the links by locals who admire the juices that squirt out and smear the meat on white bread. To eat them is bliss. The Historian, Jessica B. Harris, New Orleans, Louisiana, and New York City. For four decades, Jessica B. Harris has spoken and written eloquently, lovingly, and critically of this region's foodways, reminding all that the South is as West African as it is Western European. A fierce intellect, she has published 12 books on the cooking of the African diaspora, including Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons and The Welcome Table. Back when too few knew the difference between a yam and a sweet potato, Harris set the table for a generation of writers who followed. The Tamale Artist, Rhoda Adams, Lake Village, Arkansas. Mexican workers, recruited to the Mississippi Delta in the early years of the 20th century to pick bumper cotton harvests, likely brought tamale making here. Hot tamale stands now dot the Mississippi Delta and the strip of land that hugs the Arkansas side of the river, too. The tamales that Rhoda Adams rolled at Rhoda's Famous Hot Tamales were born of that exchange. Her half-and-half pies, on the other hand, are her own inscrutable invention. Creamy sweet potato on one side and gooey pecan nougat on the other. Tucked in an honest crust, they come in 3-inch tins. Eaten out of hand, they are idealized and delicious tokens of her ingenuity. The Reporter, Jo Ellen O'Hara, Birmingham, Alabama. Before she became a newspaper woman, Jo Ellen O'Hara got a degree in home economics, but writing was her love. After she earned a master's in journalism, O'Hara won the job as food editor on the Birmingham News in 1965. Her male editors, who predicted that she would marry and leave her role, insisted she adopt the pseudonym Sue Scattergood so the paper could easily replace her. She finally convinced them to let her write under her own name after 15 years in the position. 43 years after she became the go-to food expert, O'Hara retired from the paper in 2008, having documented the city's rise from being called Bombingham to becoming a citadel of American food culture. The Cheesemaker, Judy Shad, Greenville, Indiana. Judy Shad has led the farmstead cheese revolution since the late 1970s, starting with the milk from her children's 4-H show goats. Rather than look to France for inspiration, she read Cheese Making Made Easy and forged friendships with female craftspeople. With her cheese business, Capriolet, Shad proved a great marketer too, selling to southern chefs who want regional cheeses, like her O'Bannon, a tart chèvre wrapped in bourbon-soaked chestnut leaves. Her southern Indiana location is often called Kentuckiana. The Interpreter, Eddie Hernandez, Atlanta, Georgia. His grandmother owned bars and restaurants where he played as a child. At age 17, Eddie Hernandez immigrated from his native Monterey, Mexico to Texas, where he drummed in a cover band that played Spanish-language versions of rock anthems. In Atlanta, Hernandez worked his way into the kitchen. Together with his partner, Mike Clank, he built Taqueria del Sol into a multicultural restaurant group that suits the city's modern needs. Serving refried black-eyed peas and turnip greens spiked with chili de arbol, he has codified the 21st century southern kitchen. The front man, Goran Red Dog Avery, Birmingham, Alabama. Born to Harriet and Obie Avery, Goran grew up in the Smithfield community of Birmingham. After high school, he worked his way up to waiter and then captain at a downtown restaurant, flaming tableside dishes like Bananas Foster. When Highlands Bar and Grill opened in 1982, Chef Frank Stitt hired Avery to work the floor. Four nights a week, he charms and cajoles regulars, delivering lectures on the Florida source of the flounder in sherry sauce and the French technique employed for the scallops with sauce meuniere. 40-plus years after first tying on a waiter's apron, he is a master at the height of his powers. The Baker, Sue Nguyen, Biloxi, Mississippi. After Hurricane Katrina wrecked the coast, Le Bakery became a fulcrum for the relief and rebuilding effort, a neutral ground where the various racial, ethnic, and economic communities of Biloxi gathered for owner Sue Nguyen's banh mi sandwiches overstuffed with roast pork. Nguyen moved here from Vietnam as a girl. In the kitchens of her neighbors and relatives, she learned to make cha giao and gumbo. Le Bakery reflects her life experience in Mississippi and her will to remember what her family left behind in Vietnam. The Teacher, Marcy Cohen Ferris, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Marcy Cohen Ferris's work on Jewish foodways, marked by her book Matzo Ball Gumbo, paved the way for more inclusive understandings of Southern culinary culture. Her next book, The Edible South, charted the food history of our region and mapped a path for future scholars. A native of Blytheville, Arkansas, Ferris has taught a generation of students at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill how to read and think about the South, and she has done this important work while maintaining an infectious sense of humor. The winemaker, Gabrielle Rouse, Charlottesville, Virginia. A champion of Virginia grape growing and winemaking, Gabrielle Rouse grew up in northern Italy. In 1976, he came to Barbersville, near Charlottesville, where a short consultation became a career. Mastering complex graft work, he nurtured a nascent Virginia wine industry, coaxing old world grapes to thrive in a difficult climate. Rouse has mentored growers at dozens of vineyards, including Blenheim and Afton Mountain. In 1997, he founded his label, Gabrielle Rouse Winery. He believes the future for Virginia vineyards is bright, and he makes wines that validate his optimism. The Seed Saver, Ira Wallace, Mineral, Virginia. Raised by her grandmother in Tampa, Florida, Ira Wallace traveled the world after college. She lived on an Israeli kibbutz and on farms in Canada, Scandinavia, and North Carolina. In 1984, she settled in Virginia, where she helped found Twin Oaks Community Cooperative Farm, an early commercial maker of tofu. Today, Wallace helps direct Southern Exposure Seed Exchange, a mighty force in the fight for environmental diversity, and teaches workshops about heirloom and open-pollinated seeds, framing their importance with narratives about family and resilience. The Advocate, Greg Asbed, Immokalee, Florida. The Penny Per Pound Initiative, in which the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, CIW, used boycotts and marches to win one more penny for each pound of crop picked by those working in Florida tomato fields, has proven to be the most effective civil rights campaign of the past 20 years, lifting many people out of poverty and creating a more just food system for all. The CIW leverages the Wendell Berry dictum that eating is an agricultural act. Greg Asbed, who co-founded the organization with his wife, Laura Germano, and their colleague, Lucas Benitez, advocates for better pay and working conditions for migrant workers. An attorney by training and an activist by profession, Asbed lives by the creed he preaches, often joining CIW members to harvest watermelons in Georgia. The Tortilla Marvel, Laura Patricia Ramirez, Lexington, Kentucky. Laura Patricia Ramirez was born in the state of Jalisco in Mexico. In 1985, she and her husband arrived in Paris, Kentucky, so he could work in the horse racing business. At that point, few Latinos lived in Lexington, but now they dominate the horse industry. Ramirez opened Tortilleria y Taqueria Ramirez in 1997, in a section of Lexington nicknamed Mexington. Her carnitas tacos reflect Mexico. She also channels Kentucky, using masa from nearby Weisenberger Mills for her aromatic tortillas. The Charmer, Joanne Clevenger, New Orleans, Louisiana. A succession of talented chefs has led the kitchen since the uptown restaurant Upper Line opened in 1983, serving the roasted duck of your dreams. But chefs have not defined this place. Each night, Joanne Clevenger greets her audience in a red and black dress, fixed with her prized Girl Scout pin. A visionary restaurateur who makes a case for the role of hospitality in community building and reminds diners that the word restaurant comes from the French word to restore. She may be the best front-of-the-house person in the region, and is definitely the sort of charmer whose presence makes a night in New Orleans truly transformative. The Rancher, Jenny Harris, Bluffton, Georgia. Like her father, Will Harris III, Jenny Harris grew up in the southwestern Georgia town of Bluffton. Jenny sold cattle at 4-H conferences, and when she was 9 years old, her father reinvented the family farm, White Oak Pastures, to adopt more sustainable and responsible methods. The Harrises now raise 10 species of animals, including pigs and rabbits. Temple Grandin, the leading authority on humane animal treatment and slaughter, designed their abattoirs. Jenny now lives on the farm with her wife, Amber, and son, Jack, the sixth generation of Harrises to call this land home. The Evangelist, Shondor Katz, Liberty, Tennessee. A self-styled fermentation revivalist, Shondor Katz connects modern farm activists and back-to-the-land hippies through a commitment to preservation and craft. A one-time policy wonk, Katz left New York City in 1993 for rural Cannon County, Tennessee, where he mentors artisans and cooks. Katz, who lives with AIDS and considers fermented foods to be a part of his healing, has written 4 books, including The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved and The Art of Fermentation, that are manifestos for a new generation of activists. In the process, he's rendered fermentation a radical act. The Storyteller, Sherry Castle, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Sherry Castle was born in North Carolina's Blue Ridge Mountains. She wrote her first recipe, Hawaiian Tropic Sunset Delight, a smoothie, at the tender age of 4. At 13, she broadened her culinary horizons by making each dish in The Joy of Cooking. Since then, she's leveraged what she learned from her family of cooks to develop recipes for magazines, newspapers, and restaurants, teach at culinary schools across the nation, collaborate on books with chefs and personalities, and publish her own title, The New Southern Garden Cookbook. In the process, she has revealed herself to be our best advocate for the rich history of Southern home cooking. The Peach Farmer, Dory Sanders, Filbert, South Carolina. A peach grower and author of novels and cookbooks that illustrate and celebrate the rural South, Dory Sanders carries forward a tradition of farmers who also serve the region as writers. Her farm, in the family since 1915, has been a source of inspiration and income. In 1990, Sanders published Clover, the story of a young black South Carolina girl coming to terms with her white stepmother. Each of her books has been a gift to the region, a passkey to making connections across differences. Selling peaches at the family stand and writing books about life in rural South Carolina, she has helped knit the region together. Join the Southern Foodways Alliance. If you love this region's dishes and the stories behind them, consider becoming a member of the Southern Foodways Alliance, SFA, which celebrates the diverse food cultures of the changing American South with events, seminars, films, and an award-winning publication and podcast called Gravy. The quarterly journal is included with your membership. They're also a really nice group of folks. To join, go to southernfoodways.org. From the Southern Tales section, Petticoat, 4th of July Frights, Calm Anxious Dogs During Fireworks Displays, by Grace Haynes. Signs of Fear, Don't Expect Oohs and Ahs from Your Pet Over Fireworks Shows. Dogs feel threatened by loud and sudden sounds. It's why many develop noise phobias to things like thunderstorms. Common signs of anxiety are panting, pacing, hiding, trembling, and trying to escape, says Dr. Mark D. Freeman of the Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine. Soothing solutions. When fireworks go off, act natural. Pets are more likely to stay calm if you do too. Or put your dog in a safe space, like a crate. Ask an animal behaviorist or vet about behavior modification techniques to desensitize pets to loud noises. For example, play a recording of fireworks at a low volume while engaging in a fun activity like tug-of-war. Gradually increase the volume. If he shows signs of fear, turn it down until the reaction stops. Then start increasing the volume again, says Dr. Freeman. Thank you for listening to today's Southern Living Magazine. This has been Angela Odie saying goodbye from Owl Radio, and have a great weekend.